I guess it's easy to think that this is a golden age for environmentalism. I mean, environmentalists are all around us, and we're more aware of them than we've ever been before. But I want to argue that actually environmentalism itself is in a crisis. And I think really Extinction Rebellion shows us that environmentalism is in a crisis. We've known for decades that we need to treat the natural world better. We've known for a very long time we need to do better in avoiding damaging the natural world in which we live. And for decades we've heard rational arguments and science and facts and information to persuade us to look better after the natural world. I can remember being at school in the 1990s and we were raising money then to buy a small section of the Amazon rainforest to try and stop deforestation. I can remember 10 years ago being at a science conference in the States and Peter Raven, the director of the Missouri Botanic Garden, gave a very eloquent talk showing how many planets would be needed to support the human population if everyone had the same lifestyle as an American. And it was a large number of planets that would be needed if everyone had that lifestyle. So we've known for a very long time, we've had information for a very long time that's telling us that we need to do better on the environment. But unfortunately, we're not doing better. And this is why Extinction Rebellion are deciding they're going to have to take direct action. They're in a crisis because they haven't been able to persuade people to actually change their lifestyle. And so instead of reason and arguments, now they're trying to inconvenience people's lives to see if they can actually make us all pay attention. So in some ways, that is a crisis because they fail to persuade us by other means. So I want to think a bit about why this crisis has come about. Why is it so hard to make the case for environmentalism in the modern world? And I think the underlying problem is that to solve our environmental problems, we all need to take a drop in our standard of living. We search around for technical solutions that mean that we could maintain our current standard of living with less carbon emissions. But the reality is that to really make a difference, we have to have a drop in our comfort levels and in our levels of consumption. And that's very hard because we're all selfish. If we just think about cars, for instance, cars over the last 20 years have got heavier and bigger instead of lighter and smaller. Yes, we've got hybrid cars now. Yes, we've got electric cars. But overall, cars are a much more luxurious thing than they were in the past. Perhaps you can remember when the new Mini came out. I was in a lot of anticipation about the new Mini because my sister, when I was a schoolboy, had an old Mini, and it was tiny. It was green, and we called it the P because it was so small. The first thing that struck me when the new Mini came out was how big it was. You know, it's about 1.5 times the size of the old Mini. And this, of course, is true of many cars. I was driving behind a Tesla the other day. And of course, the Tesla is supposed to be a very green, environmentally friendly thing, but it's huge. Why does it need to be that big? I, for various reasons, ended up driving a very modern 4x4 a few weeks ago, and it had so many electronics that I didn't know what to do with them all. You know, I could have the temperature set differently for the passenger and for the driver. I could have a massage as I was going along. Everything was electronic. You know, all of these little electric motors are making our cars much heavier than they actually need to be. We're carrying around with us a level of luxury that we don't even have in our own homes. And of course, all of that is making us use more energy and emit more carbon. And this is true of every aspect of our lives, isn't it? We want to be more environmentally friendly. We want to do the right thing, but then a new iPhone comes out and I need to get that new iPhone. You know, I want to be more environmentally friendly, but then someone invents flat-screen TVs. And so, of course, I have to get rid of my old TV and get a flat-screen TV. You know, we used to manage without air conditioning in our homes, but now, well, we're just too hot in the summer. And in the winter, well, we like to be warmer than our grandparents like to be. And so, even though we want to do the right thing, we end up consuming more and more energy. We're just caught up in this torrent of consumerism. And we find it very, very hard to go against the flow. And so this is why the environmental crisis just doesn't get better. And on my way here, I was just scrolling through the Extinction Rebellion website, and even they were saying very little about the solutions to the climate problem. Even they weren't saying everyone needs to have a drop in their standard of living, although that is a reality. Everyone just says, well, the government needs to do something. The government should sort this out. But actually, all of us need to be more self-sacrificial, and all of us need to be willing to deny ourselves of the luxuries that we've become accustomed to. That's a very hard message to sell to voters. You know, we saw that in France. The French government raised taxes on petrol, partly for environmental reasons, and we saw the Yellow Vest protests. Barack Obama introduced green legislation in America. Trump was not elected for his green credentials, was he? The same in Brazil at the moment. Things are even worse for the Brazilian rainforest than they were a few years ago. Instead of moving forward in our track record on the environment, we're actually moving backwards. And so you can see why there's a sense of frustration among those who are really concerned about the environment and why they think we're losing the battle and we need to start taking direct action. Well, I want to argue that there are some fairly deep philosophical reasons why the environmental movement is in a crisis, and I want to argue that those problems can actually be solved by going back to Christianity. You might say, well, that's a strange thing to argue, because when the Bible was written, humanity simply did not have the capacity that we have today to damage the natural environment. So it wasn't really an issue back then. You know, before you had modern machinery and modern approaches to life, damaging the environment in the way we can do it today simply was not an issue. So why would the Bible have anything to say about that? Well, I think it has a lot to say about that, because it tells us a lot about our place in the world. It tells us a lot about our motivations. It tells us about right and wrong. And it gives us a hope for the future. And I'm going to argue that all of those things are very important if we want to see progress in our society on the issue of the environment. I mean, real progress, not just gestures. So first of all, the problem of humans. What are humans? And I think all of us have a pretty ambiguous attitude to this. On the one hand, we are the most sophisticated, the most sentient, the most feeling organism on the planet. You know, we are, in a sense, we're the gods of this world. We're the people who can think about things and invent things. And we naturally think that we are the most important things in the world. You know, if I think that my relationship would benefit from a holiday in the sun, then my wife and I should, you know, be able to fly for a holiday in the sun. I mean, surely that's more important than the bit of carbon dioxide we're going to emit. And in some ways, of course it is. You know, we naturally put ourselves first as humans. We think it's all about us. And so we can end up with an attitude that this world is just here to serve us. We can have a very human-centric attitude to the natural world. On the other hand, well, surely we all evolved by chance anyway. No one had us in mind. We're purposeless. We're just one species that's happened to break out of its niche on the African savannas as hunter-gatherers, and we've just become parasites on the natural world. And actually, we're the worst thing about the natural world, and the best thing that could happen would be for the human population to actually dramatically go down, or even for humans to go extinct. I've heard environmentalists argue that. Well, in many ways, that's true. The natural environment would be better off without humans. So, you know, maybe we should all just get rid of ourselves. I watched a movie a few weeks ago. It's probably one of the worst movies I've watched this year. I think it was called Kingsman. And it was about this villain who has decided to solve the environmental crisis by killing everyone. And he's foiled by a James Bond-like figure. But that's the kind of way that many people think if they're trying to be logical about putting the natural world first. Well, how do we navigate between those two things? Do we have a very human-centric attitude to the natural world, or do we have a very nature-centric attitude where actually nature is more important than us? It's very, very hard to get any kind of balance, isn't it? My first exposure to the Extinction Rebellion was when my wife was taking my one-year-old son to the hospital in the car for a follow-up to a serious medical condition that he had, and she was stopped by Extinction Rebellion protesters, and the police were just standing there doing nothing, and these guys were blocking the road. And you know what NHS appointments are like. You know, if you have this letter saying if you miss this appointment you may be referred back to your GP, you think, oh no, I'm going to have to start all over again. And you know, we felt pretty annoyed with Extinction Rebellion that day, I can tell you. It's this very difficult balance, isn't it, between humans and welfare and health and comfort and the natural environment. How do we navigate ourselves between those two extremes? That leads us to the problem of motivation. How do I motivate myself to actually deny myself and make sacrifices for the good of the planet, for the wider good? Yes, you know, it's easy to stop using a disposable coffee cup. It's easy to buy a hybrid car instead of just a petrol car. It's easy to do the recycling, at least most of the time. But what about real sacrifice? You know, when I actually start dropping my standard of living, when I start travelling less, when I start driving less, when I start wearing older clothes, where I stop having the latest iPhone, where I stop having the latest laptop, where I have my house a bit colder in the winter and a bit warmer in the summer. You know, how do I actually motivate myself to do that kind of thing? Especially when no one else is watching, and especially when other people aren't doing the same thing. You know, if there's a flight going to Sydney, why shouldn't I be on that flight just as much as anyone else? And anyway, I could spend my whole life being miserable and denying myself the luxuries I've got used to, and then Donald Trump could hit the nuclear button and the world would be destroyed anyway. You know, what's the point? It's very hard to convince anyone that they should make a sacrifice to make a tiny difference to a global problem that will affect future generations more than their own. You know, the real effects of us denying ourselves will be felt when all of us are actually dead. You know, our lives with their luxuries or their frustrations or their self-denial, you know, we won't be there anymore. If I live in an atheistic universe with no life after death, well, why should I bother, really? How can I really motivate myself? And you might say, oh, well, it's a matter of right and wrong. It's the right thing to do to look after the environment, and so you should do it just because it's the right thing. Well, you know, who said we had absolute morality? You know, who said there's really a right and wrong anymore? You know, surely we've got rid of that kind of thing. You know, if I decide to be green and environmentally friendly, I want you to respect and admire me for that. But if I don't, I don't want you to say that I'm wrong. You know, who are you to tell me that I'm actually wrong? So motivation actually becomes really difficult, doesn't it? How do you motivate the whole population to be more environmentally friendly and actually deny themselves? And I think the other problem is the problem of hope. Why shouldn't I just sink into despair and apathy about the natural environment? I personally can do very little. Global trends are pretty bad. Anything I do probably won't make a difference. Why should I actually bother? You know, any war is going to have a far bigger effect on the environment than anything I do, and wars are probably going to come along. It's very easy to just sink into despair, isn't it? And just think, okay, there's no point. David Attenborough is very good, isn't he, in his documentaries, in trying to give a bit of hope. He said this in interviews, you know, I try not to be too negative, because if I'm totally negative, people will just turn off and they'll give up trying to do anything about the natural environment. He says, I have to focus on any successes I can in order to encourage people that there is a hope. But the reality is, it's actually very hard to be very optimistic about the natural environment and about human impacts upon it. So we have those problems. How does Christianity solve them? What does Christianity do that can actually help us in this crisis of environmentalism? Well, I think it has many things. Christianity has long taught us that we shouldn't be selfish in our lives. Jesus told his followers not to lay up treasures in heaven. He himself, he had nowhere to lay his head. He didn't have a house to live in. I mean, Jesus' carbon footprint was absolutely minimal, you know, even less than the average. And of course, he came to tell us more than about our carbon footprints, and of course, carbon footprints are something which we haven't even thought about until recent decades. But Jesus' message of self-denial and not laying up things on earth and not trying to have all your pleasure here and now not living a luxurious life. You know the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man had a very luxurious existence. Everything he wanted, all the food he wanted. And the poor man had nothing at all. But then after they died, their situations were completely flipped in the parable that Jesus taught. So Jesus has been telling us for 2,000 years, luxury and pleasure in this world are not what it's about. Well, to my mind, that is a more powerful motivation not to live a life of consumption than the prospect of me having a 0.00000001% impact on climate in 100 years' time. So that's the issue of motivation. There's also the issue of humans' place in the universe. You know, are we the gods of this world, or are we parasites that need to be got rid of? Well, Christianity says neither of those things. It says God is the God of this world, and we're here because God has placed us here. He has a purpose for us here, and he set us here as stewards over his creation. You know, Adam and Eve were placed in the Garden of Eden as gardeners. Our attitude to the natural world should be that of gardeners to their garden. It's something that we use, but it's something that we look after carefully. We nurture its diversity, its variety and its beauty. If we had the attitude as humans of being the gardeners of this world, we would treat it in a very different way than we treat it at the moment. It helps us navigate between a very nature-centric view and a very human-centric view. If we have a God-centric view, we can navigate between those two extremes in a logical and coherent way. And the other problem is hope. How can we have hope? Well, Christianity gives us hope. It gives us hope for ourselves that if we do the right thing, then God will see that and God will take notice. Even if no one else is watching, if I put out the recycling or not, God is watching and God knows about it. You might say, well, actually, that makes things worse. You know, we all feel guilty, don't we, about our environmental track record. And if we bring God into it too and say God is also worried about your environmental track record, well, that makes our problem of guilt even bigger, doesn't it? That makes us even more worried. But Christianity doesn't stop there. Christianity also says, well, God also gives the chance of redemption. He gives the opportunity of forgiveness, of actually being able to make right what we've done that's wrong. If we trust in Jesus, he can deal with our problems, and not just for us as individuals, but also for the natural environment. The Apostle Paul says that when Jesus comes a second time, he's going to release creation from its bondage to decay. He will actually transform the natural world. So even if we don't manage to completely put everything right, even though we're trying to, because we're trying to be good stewards as God tells us to, we're trying to be gardeners, not exploiters like God tells us to, but even if we can't get things to how they really should be, God himself will come eventually and put it right. So we can have hope for the natural environment. We don't have to just give up in despair. God gives us a future and a hope that we can look forward to and work towards. And I think if we put all of that together, if we have the right view of who humans are, the right view of what we should be doing, the right view of the future, then that actually enables us and empowers us to have a much better attitude and relationship with the natural world around us and live lives which are genuinely more self-sacrificial, less consumptive, and better for the environment. So does environmentalism need God? Yes, I think it does, and urgently. Thank you very much.
So we're going to get through them, but Richard's going to have a go anyway. Over to you.
Thanks, Brian. Well, there's a couple of questions about along the lines of isn't it actually dangerous to say that Jesus' second coming will sort out the environment? Because it's a sort of get out of jail free card. We're off the hook. Well, Christians believe that when Jesus comes again, we'll get a new body. But I don't know any Christian who, when they're ill, doesn't want to go to hospital. I haven't seen anyone limping around with a treatable illness saying, oh, well, I'm going to get a new body when Jesus comes again, so I'm not going to bother going to the doctor. That's just not what we do, is it? And so I think it's the same with the natural world. If we can see that there are problems that need fixing, we should get on and fix them. And I think the other thing is, Christianity is bringing this moral component. God made us stewards of this world, and we have to do responsible stewardship. Just like we're good stewards of our bodies, and we work very hard on that, we've got to do the same with the natural world. And God is going to judge us on how selfish or unselfish we were when he comes again. So I think that is actually more motivation than an atheist has, really, to be environmentally friendly when we actually get down to it. So that's one question. Another one, I have unfortunately encountered a few Christians who are climate change deniers. Yeah, so have I, especially in America. And yeah, I'm not saying Christians are necessarily setting a fantastic example on this. I'm not saying that all Christians would necessarily agree with what I've said in this talk. I hope I can persuade them. But I think when we do look seriously at the Bible's teaching, this is what it's saying, and I very much try to persuade other Christians of that view. So are you saying that becoming a Christian is more important than anything we do for the environment? Well, I would say if you become a Christian, you will end up, as a side effect, living a more environmentally friendly life. I think there's actually many aspects of following Jesus' teaching which have a knock-on effect for our attitude to the environment. You know, Christians of former generations, even before we were aware of environmental problems, were trying to lead lives which were not luxurious, which weren't overindulgent. And as an unintended consequence, they were more environmentally friendly than we are today. To take another example, you know, for example, in my marriage, if my wife and I got divorced, our carbon footprint would immediately go up. Instead of needing one flat, we would need two flats. We would need two cars. We'd be shuttling our son between the two of us. You know, just by following Christian morality and staying together, we are having a carbon footprint which is smaller than it would be. And, you know, we're not doing that for our carbon footprint per se. That's quite low down in our list of priorities of why we're not getting divorced, I can tell you. But by living life in a Christian way, we are living a life which is more economical and more good for the environment. And there's lots of other ways which I can think of where just simply following God's moral teaching, there is a knock-on effect for the environment that perhaps, you know, I've not even thought about. Now, this is more the field of the expertise of the people in the room than me. You talk of reduced consumption at an individual level. The global economy would be smashed, with billions negatively impacted. Help. Well, I'm not an economist. I can see what you're saying. Our economy does rely on a huge amount of consumption. And it's these drivers which mean that all of us, even if we don't want to, do find ourselves consuming more and more. You know, when we go out to buy a new car, all of the options are big, heavy cars. When we go out to buy a TV, it's all, you know, big flat screen TVs. And so our economy is pushing us to be more and more indulgent. I think as Christians we should be going against the flow. I sometimes think about the people who are building, you know, my iPhone. You know, we hear reports about what conditions are like for workers in some of these factories, and it sounds awful. You know, I can see the world economy maybe depends on that, but on the other hand, if we weren't consuming so much in the West, would some of these people in the factories actually have a better lifestyle? I don't know. That question is above my pay grade and outside my area of expertise, but I can't help thinking that there are guys in China, for instance, who are peasant farmers who are living a happier life than many people who are at the bottom level of our consumerist society. That's just a quick take on that.
Thanks very much. You want to come back on that, Richard?
Sure, just very quickly. I totally agree with you. Christians should be focused on the new heaven and the new earth. But I think if they do that, then they will be more able to live a life of self-denial and generosity, helping others, not you know, serving ourselves and living a luxurious life in this world. So I think by being focused on the next world, we improve life for everyone and for the natural environment in this world. The other aspect is, would the Extinction Rebellion activists be so active if they were Christians? I think if they were Christians, they'd feel they had to obey the law of the land. But would they have less zeal? Well, I think sometimes you actually get more done by being indirect. I think if our zeal is mainly for God, it will actually have more positive effects on this world than if our zeal is all for this world. I think when it actually comes down to what we achieve and what we do in our lives. But you can come back to me one-to-one if you want.